Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Today is the 7th anniversary of the 13 murders at Columbine High School, including that of Danny Rohrbaugh. Danny's dad, Brian, spoke at this year's March for Life in Denver, Colorado, and I'd like to let you hear something of what Brian said that day.
I received a phone call on Tuesday. And in a panic-stricken voice that I knew well, she said, "Brian, have you heard from Dan? Do you know what's going on?" And I said, "No." Two gunmen have entered Columbine High School with machine guns and hand grenades, and they're killing kids. So me and my coworker Craig dropped what we were doing, and we headed towards the school. And we heard on the radio we'd have to go to a nearby elementary school, Leawood Elementary. And the whole way there, I prayed, "Lord, please don't let Dan be injured." When we got there, we met up with Sue, Dan's mom, and her husband, Rich. And Sue was going to wait at Leawood, and Rich was heading to the public library because we heard they were taking kids there. Craig and I decided to walk around the neighborhood and see if we could get a view of the school and see what was happening. And we came up to a street that had a park at the end. And from there, you could see the school. There were a couple police cars and officers there, so we couldn't go any further. And we were standing there watching, and a lady burst out her front door. And she was screaming and crying, and she said to the police, "Help that boy. Save him. Do something. Help that boy." Unfortunately for a young man who was climbing out the second story window of the library after being shot, the Lakewood police took a van with an officer on top, and they got him and got him to a hospital, and he survived. Now, that was probably the first time I realized how bad things were. As the seconds turned to minutes, and the minutes turned to hours, I realized Dan was gone. I could just feel it. I can't describe it any other way. And I prayed, "Lord, please don't let this be true. Let it be emotion." And we headed back to Leawood, and they started bringing school buses full of kids. And we watched as everyone got off the bus. And they ran to their families, and they hugged and they cried, and they were met all too often with the hollow promise that you'll never set foot in that school again. And family after family left with their kids. When the last bus came, it was empty. I went inside Leawood with Rich and Sue, and I told Sue, "You know, this isn't going to end very well for us. Dan's gone." And a counselor came running up and said, "No, no, no, don't give up hope. Don't give up hope. There's another bus coming." And I said, "Have you no decency? My son's dead. Would you please leave us alone?" And the sheriff, John Stone, and the DA, Dave Thomas, came in. And they stood in front of us and they said, "We don't have any information. We don't know anything. By the way, here's the coroner." And the coroner said, "I don't know anything yet. We're just starting our investigation. But you can go home. You can use your phone. Do whatever you need to do. Because if we find that one of your family members is here, we're going to send an officer to your home tonight to notify you." And with that, I decided to go home. And Rich and Sue stayed till 9:30 or 10 when they were finally sent home. That was Tuesday, April 20th, 1999. The next morning, we opened the newspaper, and there was a picture of a young man wearing a green shirt and blue jeans, lying dead on the sidewalk of Columbine High School. My son. They left him laying there 27 hours, and that seemed like an eternity.
Okay, we heard how this started for the family of Danny Rohrbaugh. And now I would like to ask his dad, Brian, what happened next. But first, Brian, thank you for being here in studio. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So what did happen next?
Well, that was Wednesday, April 21st, that we opened the paper. Later that day, a longtime family friend called me, and she said, you know, we're so sorry. We'd like to come up and spend some time with you. And Jim, her husband, was working, but she said that he has to speak to you. He's got something really important to tell you, so he wants to come up after work. So they came up, and when Jim got there, he sat down and told me that he had witnessed Dan's death. He was an Arapahoe County police officer,
wow.
And he said he was on the scene and witnessed Dan's death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we didn't think anything of it other than, you know, obviously we are happy to hear what he could tell us, not happy that it happened, but that we had some information.
Yeah.
Because at the time, there really wasn't good information. There was a lot of rumors. There was a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we listened to it and kind of set it aside. And then we were planning really the worst thing a parent ever gets to plan, which is a funeral and what we're going to do. And a few days later, a producer from CNN contacted me and said, we're going to have a roundtable discussion. We'd like you to be on it. And so I asked him a little bit about it, who they thought would be on it, you know, what they were going to cover, and I agreed. Now, later that day, I was telling my wife, Lisa, that, you know, I agreed to do this, but I don't really know what to expect. I need to talk to someone from two perspectives. I need to talk to someone who understands the media and can tell me what to expect. But I also need to talk to someone who understands the Bible better than I do, because if I'm going to be on national TV for 2 hours, I want to represent Jesus Christ in a way that would be pleasing to him.
Mm.
You know, and I didn't really know where to turn, and we talked about it. And so after, you know, some debate and all, because really, where do you turn when you want to go talk to someone who understands the Bible and the media? But I realized I know where we'll go. So we got in the car. We didn't try to set up an appointment. We just headed off. And we'd never been there before, but I had the address, and I remember it was raining really hard. And then it would let up, and you could see, and then it'd start raining hard, and you could barely see. And when we got there, you know, we parked, and I was thinking, you know, the most important people are always on the upper floors of these buildings. And you know, we went in, and there was the classic setup. You've been in a building like this before, where you go in and there's someone there for information and there's a guard. And we went up to the guard and told him who we wanted to see. And they had a sign in and directed us to the elevator. Then when we got up to the floor, there was another guard, and we told him what we were there for. And he said, well, I'll see if he's available. You know, you can wait over there. And a few minutes later, out comes this scruffy-looking guy with a very puzzled look on his face. And I told him who I was and what I was there for. And I would have liked to have shaken your hand, Bob, but I couldn't, because you were separated from me by plexiglass, and we were talking on a jail phone back and forth.
Jefferson County Jail.
Right. And
I was an inmate.
You were an inmate.
Anybody doesn't get it.
Right. You were an inmate, and I needed some advice, and so I told you what we were there for. We had 15 minutes to talk about it.
And for our Iowa audience, who's just recently found Bob and Yurt Live. I was in jail for trying to be a good dad, spanking my stepson 5 swats on the backside, and it left 3 red marks. And Jeff Coe went after me relentlessly, and in fact, we eventually had a number of jury trials. We won one jury trial. We had another mistrial, another trial. I lost, and we appealed, and I won. Finally, they had another trial, and they got me, and they put me in jail for about 4 months was the sentence, I think.
Yeah, so I had never met you before, and I told you who I was and why I was there. And you were kind of a captive audience, as to speak. I told you about the round table, and you asked me who would be on it, and I told you that there'd be
– Now, Columbine just happened
days before.
Just days before, and I was in jail, and we watched it unfold on the TV news in jail.
Right.
And the command center that was parked behind the jail was gone all of a sudden, and we noticed that. We said, wow, I wonder what's going on. The command center's not here.
Right. So you had followed Columbine through the media, and so we were talking about who would be on the roundtable, and I told you the superintendent of the schools would be there, and the sheriff and the district attorney, who at the time I had no reason to mistrust in any way. And there'd be some students there and some other people from the community and a pastor. And I don't know if you remember, but you said to me, you better watch out for the pastor. He will be your enemy. Mm. And we talked about that for a minute or two, and I got to tell you, I was taken back by that statement. But we went through as much as we could in 15 minutes, and I remember being impressed because as I was writing notes, you were reading my handwriting upside down to make sure that I had everything,
all
you know, correct,
references.
Right, the correct Bible verses and all. And about the time they were coming to take you back, I ask you if you had seen the newspaper where someone had erected 15 crosses. Knowing that there were 13 innocent victims, including my son, there were 2 murderers, but someone had put up 15 crosses.
Devastating.
Do you remember what you said?
I would think I would said that's evil.
Yeah, you did. You said that's evil, and you said, I am so sorry they're doing that to you. It's wrong. Mm-hmm. Those crosses shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
So on the evening when this special was getting ready to air, we were seated and they had all the microphones and cameras set up. And they told us they were going to start with a film clip introduction. And then the host, Judy Woodruff, was going to come to me and ask me a question. And so she turns to me after the clip and she says, Brian, why did you take down those crosses?
The 2 crosses.
For the murderers. Hmm. And so I got to talk about that. I told her that you don't place a statue of Adolf Hitler inside a Holocaust museum because it's wrong. It's evil to honor murderers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that started several months of very public debate on things like forgiveness and on right and wrong and on honoring murderers and in making excuses mm-hmm. for people who do evil.
And this public debate took the form of virtual Bible study, sometimes on Good Morning America and talk shows all over the country, talk radio. And I remember eventually a 2-page photo in People magazine, and there's the verse Luke 17:3, which says, if someone sins against you, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. And that was what was in People magazine. If he repents, if, forgive him.
Right. Well, and it really did cover a broad spectrum of media, and I can't tell you how many interviews I did and how many appearances I made, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of them. And what was really interesting to me is the secular world got it, and the ones who hated me the most seemed to be from the Christian community that doesn't really study their Bible, but they study the cliches.
The cliches that you have to forgive everyone. And what that tells people is that you don't have to repent. And then they don't. They think God will forgive them automatically. Forgiveness is automatic, but it's not. Jesus said, if he repents, forgive him. And God waits for us to repent before he gives us salvation. We have to ask him, tell him we're sorry for ignoring him throughout our lives.
Well, that's exactly right. And like I say, the secular world, they understood that pretty well. Mm. They understood that you don't just turn your head and say, oh, it's okay that you murdered my son. or anyone else for that matter, and that it is appropriate to both judge and to question. Mm-hmm. And if someone repents, then we have an obligation to forgive them. Mm-hmm. I can assure you that the two murderers at Columbine didn't repent.
No. They murdered themselves at the end of their murder spree, and they also injured many people. And they hated God from the basement videos. We know they hated Jesus Christ. They believed in evolution, and they didn't repent. Right.
Right. And you mentioned the basement videos, and you're aware that we're still involved in a legal fight to get those released. Now, Jefferson mm-hmm. County,
the
Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Johnstone, cut a deal with Time Magazine where they gave them access to these videotapes. And then Time Magazine wrote a big story about it. And then they played those for the families. I've seen them multiple times and examined them hour after hour. I've probably got 40 pages of notes on the stuff that went on in the videotapes. And then they locked them away and said, oh, these belong to the Klebolds and Harrises. They're not public. And they started using taxpayer dollars to represent the Klebolds and Harrises, trying to keep these sealed. And so we're at the 7th anniversary, and they're still not released.
Is it only the videos that Jeffco is helping the Harris and Klebold family keep secret?
No. So far, through Freedom of Information request, we've got about 53,000 pages of documents released. But there's another 3,000 that I saw under a seal of a federal court, which I am not supposed to talk about because while the criminals go free, they would surely put me in jail.
Right.
There's that documentation. There's other writings. There's really important documents that the public needs to see that need to be released. And, you know, all of these things won't make a bit of difference for my son, but they might for someone else's. And they certainly make a difference for understanding and trying to prevent a school shooting. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I would agree, and you knew this long before I did, that the public school is not a place for Christians to have their kids.
No.
It's wrong to let a pagan raise your children in the way of the world when you want them to spend eternity with you and with Christ. Mm. It's evil for you to do that. And the myth that they can be salt and light, that is just a myth. Mm. They're not mature enough to take on the battles that happen in that school.
They're children.
And after all, Christ didn't start his ministry at age 6 or 8.
Right.
You know, he didn't go to the pagan school
right.
and try to change it.
Right.
He learned the ways. Then he taught the ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so the examples are clear to us.
And of course, he's God, our creator, but then he was born and grew up.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, you know, obviously my son died for my foolishness of letting him attend that government school. And I certainly don't want to see that happen to anyone else. But since Columbine, it's happened a whole bunch.
Many times. And none of the warning signs seem to make any difference. Jeffco, the sheriff's department, they were saying if only there were warning signs. We need to learn to see the warning signs. You had the Brown family go to Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, bring printouts of Eric Harris's website where he made death threats. He's describing the pipe bombs. They went repeatedly. They met with the bomb squad of Jeffco. And then after Columbine, Jeffco denies that these meetings took place, that they saw the death threats. Jeffco had started an application for a search warrant, and they lied about it and said there never was such an application.
Yeah, and 5 years later, when the attorney general in Colorado held a grand jury, he was asked by Dateline if that search warrant should have been acted upon, if it had enough information. And he said yes.
Dateline NBC.
Right. And this is Ken Salazar. He's now a U.S. senator.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, it should have been acted upon. So even though they've tried to call it a search warrant application and act like it's some trivial document mm-hmm. that wasn't finished, the reality is it was finished. And the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in Colorado said not only was it finished, it should have been acted upon.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, they lied about it. Now, in the roundtable television program that I was on, John Stone sitting on one side of me and Dave Thomas sitting a couple chairs over on the other side, they said you can disregard the reports from Brooks Brown because by that time the Browns had come out and said, hey, we warned you.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeffco was saying we had no warning signs. They actually said Brooks Brown is a suspect, so you can disregard what the parents are saying. Mm. And so national TV, they accuse this guy
of lying
and being part of the massacre.
And they knew it was true. They had these documents with them as Columbine is unfolding. They knew they had this evidence. They had the ultimate warning sign, neon lights flashing. And for some reason we don't know, they never acted upon it.
Well, we may know what that is. We'll get to that in a while. And one of the things we're going to do in this program and probably in the next program is we're going to play some recordings that I made of my interviews with Jeffco. That is, 5 months after my son was murdered, when they finally met with us to tell us what happened, I recorded that. And I'm going to play some clips from that. I'm also going to play some of the recording from police officer Jim Taylor, who said he witnessed my son's death. And I think the audience will be able to understand, you know, the difference between the two accounts. And we'll talk about what we learned, what we now know about Jefferson County, what they did intentionally to deceive my family and the world.
And it turns out, and we'll start playing these clips right now, these have never been heard before. And what the audience needs to know is things that the police officers are going to say were blatant lies. They're going to describe how Danny was killed. And Brian, we know that they're lies now, right?
That's correct.
Because of ballistics, because of the clothing that was eventually released, because of El Paso County doing an investigation and saying that Jefferson County lied about the specifics of how your son was killed.
That's correct. And I think what the audience, what you need to know, if you haven't followed the story, you wouldn't know this. But between what Jim Taylor, Arapahoe County police officer and family friend, told me, and what Jefferson County told me and withheld from me, they implicated a police officer in the shooting death of my son. The combination of what they did led to the evidence trail that was available pointing directly to a police officer who was on scene. And so they caused that to happen. And because of the overwhelming evidence that we had, then the Attorney General of the state of Colorado stepped in. And an investigation was started with El Paso County, and then the grand jury investigation was started from a report, once again, that was filed not in 99, not in 98, but in 1997, warning of the danger of Klebold and Harris. So you have all that time. Well, that report never surfaced until a couple years after Columbine. So he called a grand jury to find out why. And even though they were only trying to find out what happened to this report, they uncovered what has to be called a conspiracy.
Right.
20 government officials from Jefferson County, all the county attorneys, the district attorney, the assistant district attorney, the sheriff, John Stone, Kickbush, his one of his assistants, the undersheriff, Dunaway, one of the assistant county attorneys, a woman by the name of Lily Offler, has now been promoted to a judge in Jefferson County by our Republican governor, Bill Owens.
That's right.
And these people met in the hours after Columbine. They had three secret meetings, and none of us knew about them until this grand jury just happened to turn them up. And in those meetings, they agreed to destroy some evidence and to withhold others and never to discuss the search warrants and the reports that were written by the Browns and the juvenile records in which Harris said, I'm homicidal. You know, he told him, I want to kill people. They wanted to hide all of this overwhelming evidence.
And they knew about this stuff going in. In fact, for the most part, when Columbine started, everybody knew who it was. Everybody knew it was Harrison Klebold.
Within the first minute or two, their names were being broadcast on the radio. That is the first minute or two of the dispatch tapes.
Right.
Their names are being mentioned by name. They knew. The police knew. Klebold and Harris families knew. Everyone around knew it was them.
The Brown family knew. They had gone to Jeffco and said, they're making death threats. Here are their death threats. Here's the pipe bombs they're describing. And for some reason, Jeffco decided not to take action. It didn't fall through the cracks like they've said on occasion because of other crimes, because other crimes had happened.
Well, in Jefferson County, I believe, is the biggest sheriff's department in the country. Of course, there's always simultaneous crimes. And that was a really ridiculous excuse to say we didn't act upon it. But worse than that, we have the information that shows that the detectives working on that report of the bombs and of the search warrants went back to those.
Mm-hmm.
They were set aside for a short time and then they went back
because of other crimes.
Right.
Then they went back to them and for some reason.
And they were ordered to stop working on them.
And we don't know why yet.
We do not know exactly why yet.
So now let's play some of these clips that we're going to explain what people are hearing and things that are blatant lies being told to you and your family.
Yeah, we're going to play track 11, and this is an investigator, Randy West, and the lead investigator of Columbine, Kate Batten. And in these series of clips we're going to play, you're going to hear one or both of them, and they will start out describing an overview of the crime, and then we'll go into more detail. And I want you to keep in mind, this is with my family setting in here for the first time hearing these things almost 5 months after my son had been murdered. And when I say my family, I mean myself and my wife, Lisa, Dan's mother, Sue Patrone, and Rich Patrone, and then Matt Patrone, Herb Patrone, and Nicole Patrone, which are Rich's kids. Mm-hmm. We were all there in this room listening to this. So let's play track 11.
Talk about April 20th, begin about 11:15 in the morning. And what we're going to do is walk through everything that occurred, beginning outside. As we do that, we'll talk about Brian being shot. But we're going to continue. I'm sorry. Brian, I'm sorry about that. Danny being shot. And then we're going to continue on, though. And then we're going to come back after we're done with that part of it and be very specific about Danny. And we can tell you what he was shot with, who shot him, and we can show you photos of the weapons as they had them that day, show you photos of the bombs and stuff that they had, as well as show you photos of the way Klebold and Harris appeared that day off the video from the cafeteria. We got still photos and just the way they appeared. And then, of course, any questions that anybody has, please ask at any time, okay? We're going to give a pretty specific overview. And we, like I said, we just share specifics about each kid.
All right. So in that clip, they're going to give us the overview of the entire crime, which, of course, is a good idea to understanding the timeline, what happened, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to come back and give us specifics about what happened to Dan. So let's go on and play track 12.
They walk up to the top of the stairs, and at that point, it's 11:22, when they open up their duffel bag, and inside their duffel bag is pipe bombs and CO2 bombs and their two shotguns. They take their shotguns out and they start shooting at 11:22. The first series of shots go towards the west entrance, and that injures Richard Castaldo and kills Rachel Scott. Those two, I don't know which one got shot. They were right next to each other, so probably pretty quickly.
What?
Okay. Now, in this, they're describing the first people shot outside of the school, and for those who don't know, my son was outside as well. But tragically, where they said Richard Castaldo was shot and then Rachel Scott was killed,
mm-hmm.
That's not exactly true.
No.
Sadly, Rachel Scott was shot the first time at that point, and their official report says she was the first one to die. But we now know that Rachel Scott was the 12th victim to die. The only one who died after her was Dave Sanders.
The teacher.
And that Rachel Scott was injured and laid there and died 12th. We know that factually. We know it from video clips. We know it from the rescue attempt made that's also on video from the paramedics, mm-hmm. and the firemen, police. And there is no question about it. But they lied about it because they wanted it to fit a time frame – where they said no one was injured or died outside when they were there, that they got there after all of that happened. Mm-hmm. And, of course, by saying that Rachel died quickly or before they got there, then they didn't have to deal with what were you doing when you were there. Mm-hmm. And that, from the very beginning, was one of their big issues with was how do we tell a story that fits to make people let us off the hook for not doing our job.
Right. They want to come across as having done everything properly, and there was immediate criticism, intense, all over the country. Why did so much time go by without Jeffco responding to the killers? As this crime is unfolding, why all the inaction? And so they're telling a story.
And we heard a lot of ridiculous things. We heard things like, we didn't know it was an active shooter. We thought it was a hostage, except that the first seven or eight officers on scene could hear the kids in the library being murdered. Mm-hmm. There was an open 911 call to dispatch where they heard the kids being shot and murdered in the library. There was overwhelming evidence it was an active shooter. Right. They all knew it. Then they came out and said, we didn't know what to do about it. This is a new scenario. Well, you can go back to, I believe, 1964 in the school tower in Texas when a guy was shooting students and it was an active shooter. This is not new. It is prepared for, but in this case, the murders were allowed to happen while a handful of people went the other way. And by people, I mean police officers. Now, I'm not condemning everyone who was there. In fact, most of the people who were there were really good people, mm-hmm. and they wanted to do something. But the first handful of people there and then the command structure was utterly corrupt.
And for some reason, the command structure was not giving commands. There were SWAT on the scene. There were officers who wanted to go in, and they would not be given a mission.
Well, and we'll talk about that more because I can tell you what I think was going on in there. Mm-hmm. So let's go on and play track 13.
And the other shots occur up here, and then Dylan Klebold walks down the stairs and at very close range then shoots Danny twice more. All the shots are left side entrance, and, of course, the two, I think, one about here and one up just a little higher. And that's with the Tech 9. But again, we're talking very close range.
Okay. So what you just heard was him describing how Dan was fatally shot, that they said Klebold came down and shot him twice with the Tech 9 at very close range. Mm-hmm. And so the next track we're going to hear would be track 14. You'll hear what it is. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
How many minutes between the first shot?
You know, this whole thing takes 4 minutes. Is that right, Kate? 4 minutes?
They start shooting at 11:22 and then walk in the door at 11:26.
But so the first round of shots go back this way. The boys walk out, and then the second round comes down. So I don't know specific times, but I'll try and answer you as best as I can. And that's obviously very quick. I think they see things going on, and they walk out. And I would guess that's somewhere right around a minute or less after these first shots are going back. Then these shots occur out here. And then, again, there's movement up and down, and then finally Klebold walks down. So, again, I would say the first minute, the initial shot, and then anywhere from a minute to about 2 minutes later, down.
And he was right by Lance, wasn't he?
Right. They're very close.
Every single thing that happens, like we just told you about, is supported by more than one witness. The evidence, and then ballistics.
Okay. So, again, this becomes very important. This is Investigator Kate Batten, lead investigator for the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department stating, everything they just told us is supported by at least two eyewitnesses, physical evidence, and ballistics. And I'll tell you, folks, what they said is a flat lie. They knew it was a lie.
Right. And it's now confirmed that they were
lying.
It is
confirmed not only by us but by an independent investigation from El Paso County.
Right.
The evidence that we, through court proceedings and Freedom of Information request, we were able to prove that their own ballistics, they recovered one bullet. The one bullet they recovered would have been one of the shots they said came from Klebold, but it positively did not come from Klebold's gun. Their own ballistics proved that. And in fact, Jefferson County could not positively identify the one bullet they recovered to any of the weapons they tested. Now, that's what their report says, yet they told us this. Regarding eyewitnesses, well, most of the eyewitnesses' stories have no validity whatsoever. But that's not a surprise because when you're in the middle of this type of thing, it'd be very difficult to really be coherent with what happened. But when they said that, it's just not true. I have all those witness reports. I've read them all. They're just not accurate.
Brian, is the next clip when you ask for Danny's clothing?
Yes.
Now, I'd like you to explain to the audience how hard it was to get his clothing and that you finally did get the clothing.
Well, it was very difficult. And again, you're hearing a meeting that took place 5 months later, the first time they'd met with us to describe the crime and what had happened to Dan. And Dan's mother, Sue Patrone, asked for the shoes back. And I want you to hear what happens in the next couple of tracks. And then we'll talk about how we ultimately got the clothes and why they're important. That's track 16.
And because of biohazard, we can't release those.
Can I have your shoes?
I don't think they have any blood on them.
I think they might.
Do they?
Well, I want them. If they have a biohazard, we can't.
We can't. It's law. I mean, I know.
Okay. So what you heard is you heard Randy West say that if they have blood on the shoes, they're a biohazard and we can't release them because it's a law.
That can't be true.
That was a lie. And let me tell you something. They had already released the clothing to a couple of other victims at that time. But to us, they were saying there was a law. And Sue wanted the shoes of her only son who was murdered at Columbine High School. And this is how they treated her. And it's really disturbing. Of course, I was there originally, but just the thought of how they behaved and what they did to us. The next clip, let's play 17. And I want you to hear what my wife had to say about this. She's a nurse, and she had a different perspective on it. I want you to pay attention to how they react to her.
I'm not sure that, again, looking at these, I don't think that there probably is. But
you know, we release clothes from the hospital to families that have blood on them from accidents. Is there a difference with this law? We release everything to our families.
We don't.
And so the meeting turned fairly hostile at that point in time. And we ultimately, through court proceedings, got these clothes released. It was a couple years later. And after we got them released, we sent them off to a forensics expert who said they've already been tested. And he retested them. And what he found is there were no powder burns. There was no physical evidence whatsoever to support the claims that Dan was laying on the sidewalk when he was shot or that he had been shot at very close range, which would have had powder burns on it. And in fact, shortly after that, we got a letter sent from Jefferson County to CBI, Colorado Bureau of Investigations, in which Jeffco stated, and I'm paraphrasing, but they stated that these clothes, this is what we think happened to Dan. If you can find any evidence to support our theory, these clothes will never be subject to testing again. Now, I take that to mean they will destroy the clothes if CBI will give them a checkoff on it and say, yeah, it supports what you have. And you can do a media search and find that document as well, but I think we'll post it on the website.
We'll post it on KGov, and we'll keep it associated with this program indefinitely, Brian, so people could see that. So with Rachel Scott, they say she's the first one killed, and it is absolutely now documented that she died 12th, not first. And so they're telling a story. You know, if at first we deceive, what a tangled web we weave.
Right.
They're telling a story with an agenda to exonerate their behavior. And as you start doing that, you get deeper and deeper into lies and deceptions. And so everything they said that as facts, we know what happened to Danny. We now know that they were lying on each particular.
Well, and let's play track 18. Again, this is Weston Batten, and they're describing Dan's exit wounds. And pay close attention to the conversation here. We'll talk about it.
One exited out to the right, right back here.
Right.
And I, do you know if we recovered that one or not? I'm not sure.
Yes. I'm curious what his position was when he was shot.
It fragmented.
His position is pretty much exactly the way he was, even though he's moved.
So if he was shot here and out here, then he'd be into the sidewalk.
Possibly, but not necessarily.
But I don't understand though, that picture from the Rocky Mountain News, he's laying on his stomach. And if he was already dead, then how would they, when they came back and shot him, how could they have shot him?
But that picture is taken after he's already been shot the second time.
Yeah. But he's laying down. See, here he's flipped up this way, but there he was laying on his stomach. So how would...
Okay, and the voice you heard at the end was Rich Petrone. And a couple things in that little clip that are really important. Kate Batten says they got a fragment of the bullet. The facts are Dan was shot 3 times. They recovered 1 bullet. The 1 bullet they claimed came from Klebold, and they could prove it. Their own evidence proved that they were lying, that it didn't come from Klebold, and they knew it didn't come from Klebold. Mm-hmm. There were no bullet
that
fragments.
That was their ballistics. Their ballistics
right.
indicated that bullet did not come from Klebold.
Right, absolutely confirmed it didn't come from Klebold. Mm-hmm. And what Rich is questioning them about is if Dan's laying on his back and Klebold shoots him from the front, and we know he was shot from the front with an upward trajectory on the bullet had to hit the sidewalk.
Right.
And you hear Randy West say not necessarily. And then you hear the next interesting thing that happens, which is Rich pointing out that the newspaper photo, which was taken just moments after Dan was killed, mm-hmm. confirmed the position he was in. Yet they moved him to another position to show us crime scene photos to fit the scenario of what they wanted to tell us.
Of what they were telling.
And then when Rich starts saying, I don't get it, it doesn't make sense, you hear Randy West say, well, that was taken after he was killed. Well, that's true. Theirs were taken the next morning. Mm-hmm. But the photo of Dan and the evidence around him was very consistent with the coroner's report. And what they were saying just wasn't.
And if Klebold is standing above Danny at very close range, which Randy West says repeatedly.
Right.
And he shoots a bullet, and that bullet went right through your son.
That's correct.
Right through him, came out the back of his shirt. It would have went into the sidewalk.
Well, that's exactly right. And through another quirk, we have the sidewalk on which Danny was shot and killed. Mm-hmm. When they decided to remodel the school, actually, that started before we had this meeting with these detectives, one of the guys from the school, Sue, said she wanted a little piece of the sidewalk. And the guy said, why don't I give you the whole thing? Mm. And so they checked with the pictures, found the correct piece, and removed a great big section and gave it to Sue, took it to her house and did all of that. And that sidewalk has no damage on it.
No.
Now, that's something we wouldn't have had and no one would have thought about. But on top of all the other evidence, there's not even a mark on the sidewalk to support what they're saying.
And the most startling thing of all this to me, well, aside from the fact that they're lying, is the way they lied, saying there's a law, we can't release your son's clothes because it's a biohazard, when because of Freedom of Information filing, you found out they had already released clothes to other families, and they wouldn't to Danny. They didn't want it tested. You guys tested it. You had it tested. And they said, there's no way, there is no residue on this clothing. This was not a close-range shooting.
That's right. There was absolutely nothing in those to support what they were saying.
And they knew it. They had the clothes tested.
They knew it. They had all the evidence.
They had the ballistics.
They had absolutely everything, and they fought us tooth and nail to keep us from getting these in court. And I think they were surprised the very first time we went to court. I was the only one who testified of the families that were represented by Barry. And we went in. I testified what the issues were, and the judge says, tell you what, I'll look through the 11,000 pages in camera and redact what needs to be redacted, and you can have them. Mm. Well, they testified that there were only 13,000 pages total, and we weren't asking for the bomb information because we didn't see that as relevant. So it came down to 11,000 pages. Now we're up to 53,000 pages.
Mm.
So they've lied in court numerous times mm-hmm. about what they had and what they knew.
Barry Arrington was
Barry Arrington attorney. Was representing us, and so we've been able to pry information loose, not everything, but what happened here is really stunning, and it's going on to this day. There are still documents being withheld. There's still secret files, and understanding what happened at Columbine is the only way to learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And the corruption that keeps them covering it up, even through two different sheriffs, points to something really tragically wrong. And everything we're talking about, unless I tell you it's my opinion, it's well documented, mm-hmm. and I have the proof for everything I'm saying.
Now, there was another officer who told you what had happened to your son.
That's correct. Jim Taylor, Arapaho County police officer, on Wednesday, April 21st, one day after Dan was killed, came to my home and he told me that he witnessed the crime, that Dan was running away and he saw him get shot. He also told me there was a police officer off to his left. He heard automatic gunfire, you know, that there was a gun battle going on. And that he saw this boy running away, who once he saw the picture in the paper said he realized it was Dan.
He told you that on Wednesday the 21st.
Right.
And again months later.
Well, the recordings that we have here are from 11 months later. And for 2 years, this man maintained the story, said it was accurate, said he mm-hmm. saw it. And interestingly enough, his account matched the coroner's report.
Hmm.
When Jeffco's didn't. Now, when he first told us this one day later, we, of course, were happy to hear the information
Any
because
information.
We were desperate for information.
Right.
But we had no reason to think it would be different than what Jeffco told us.
Right.
But when Jeffco told us some of the things you've just heard, and it was clear what they were saying was dishonest. I mean, if you're laying on your back and you're shot, bullets do not change direction unless they hit something. And we knew from the autopsy it went straight in, straight out. It had to hit the pavement.
And how about the thought of Danny being shot in the leg and then just laying there for minutes?
Well, that was always troubling to us.
Yeah.
And it was actually very painful to be hearing that scenario.
Yeah,
and then you hear Kate Batten say they have a bullet fragment.
Mm.
And when we get the evidence released, no bullet fragment.
Nope. Now, Brian, we only have time, I think, for this last clip or so. But I think the audience needs to know that when you went public with this, this officer, Jim Taylor, publicly through a press release from the sheriff, called you a liar.
He sure did. He said he never said any of these things to us, never did anything that would indicate that he was a witness.
Mm-hmm.
And so why don't we play track six?
When I come around, I pulled into the parking lot, and I come in there pretty fast, and I could hear glass breaking above where I was at, you know, where I come in.
Uh-huh.
And I've only been to that school once. That was that day.
Right.
I come around there, and I'm facing actually eastbound when I come in there because I cranked the Huey, and kids are still running out of the building, and, you know, you can hear glass breaking, and you can see kids running everywhere. That's when I see the boy coming down the sidewalk, you know, and I see him just fall down. And that's the first thing I told Pam. I said,
He walked in that night and he says, I'll never get rid of this seeing this.
And
he said, this kid reminded me of Brad.
It was. So I'm getting called by my commanders to report to the east side of the building. So we got about 7 or 8 Arapahoe County guys, you know, that responded, you know, because we're pretty close. We get over there, we start forming up, you know, to try to make entry into the building. And then they call us off. They said that they had.
And let's go ahead and play track 7. This is a long conversation, and he goes into great detail. The other voice you heard was his wife, Pam, mm-hmm. who was a neighbor of mine way back in 1972. And I've known these people a very long time mm-hmm. and had no reason not to believe them. And this story maintained its consistency from the very first time mm-hmm. up until the point he called us liars.
What I seen is him, I seen a boy coming down the sidewalk. You know, kind of running, you know, fast trot, but there's 20 or 30 other kids around, you know, I don't even know the number, you know, just running in mass chaos. And I see a boy drop, and that's, I didn't know who it was.
Is that that one kind
of? And it was there all, you think it was Dando, or you don't know?
It was Dana.
No,
the And I didn't know that
stoner.
Until I seen the photos, you know, the next morning in the newspaper.
Now, that recording is somewhat noisy, but you hear Rich say, was it Dan or you didn't know? And he says, no, it was Dan, and that he confirmed that with the newspaper photo. Mm. And again, his story fit the physical evidence and the reports, and we knew Jefferson County was lying. Well, what this leads to is because of Jefferson County's deceit and Jim Taylor's behavior, we ended up with believing that a police officer had shot and killed Dan. Mm. And these two agencies implicated a police officer through what they did.
Right. Because of the lies.
Right. Because of the lies and because of the eyewitness mm-hmm. account placing police officers there, firing in Dan's direction when we knew he was shot from the front, not mm-hmm. the back, and Taylor saying he was running away from Klebold and Harris.
Right. And so then Jeffco would have a plausible motive in lying. Maybe they're trying to cover up that Dan was accidentally killed by an officer. But who knows why they're lying, but also the fact of their inactivity at the beginning. Why weren't they going in? And then the lies about Harrison Klebold and there was no search warrant and all that, all those lies. So this is a mess, Brian, and we're out of time. Could we continue? I know there are more clips. These clips have not been heard by the public.
That's right.
Could we continue with this tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us on this, the 7th anniversary of the 13 murders at Columbine High School. And thank you, all of you, for listening. And we will take that letter that Jeffco sent to El Paso County, and we'll post that on the internet at kgov.com. And you've got to get the DVD where Brian Rohrbaugh spoke at this year's March for Life in Denver. We have it available. It's only $9.95. You will be stunned if you watch this DVD. So call us at 800-8-NYART. This is Bob Enyart reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.